Good morning and welcome to another edition of the Your Financial Editor program right here on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD and of course streaming live worldwide at WFMD.com. I am Chris Murray, your host. Thanks so much for being with us this Saturday morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day. Hope you enjoyed yesterday and last night. And we have a full plate for you today. I've got some top stories I'll share with you, some economic information. The Federal Reserve had their two-day meeting this week. Get you some insight into that. Also, I'm going to be talking about navigating your financial journey. So up to retirement and through retirement, some of the important things that you want to keep in mind and the impact of a long-term healthcare need. I guarantee it, if you don't have a story of your own, you know somebody who has gone through that situation where they've had to be a caregiver or a co-caregiver, or perhaps financially they had to get involved. Or it impacted them financially because of the monies that it took to satisfy that need for the person. Obviously that would be an impact for future generations there. I was talking about some top stories. I'll tell you, no matter where you look these days, pretty much the data is positive. And it's not just the data, but it's also kind of the words coming out of various leaders and business owners and executives these days. A couple of reports came out this week I wanted to share with you. Leaders of the largest U.S. companies are becoming more optimistic about sales growth, hiring, and capital investment. And that caused a measure of chief executive sentiment to increase by the most in 7 years. So there's an organization called the Business Roundtable CEO, it's called the Business Roundtable, but they have a CEO Economic Outlook Index. It rose 19 points in the first quarter from where it was in the fourth quarter. It's at a reading of 93.3. The survey came out on Tuesday. And I noticed when going over it that it was the largest one-quarter gain for the index since the fourth quarter of 2009. So a really big move there for the Business Roundtable Economic Outlook Index as far as CEOs go. Now, the CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, is currently the chairman of the Business Roundtable, and he said that he's enthusiastic about the opportunity to enact a meaningful pro-growth agenda that will benefit all Americans, and that business confidence and optimism have increased dramatically. So you're talking about, like I mentioned, some of the major CEOs in America. A lot of these folks have already met with the new president, as have union leaders and individuals from various sectors of the economy, whether it would be pharmaceutical or energy. So that was very encouraging to see the Business Roundtable. And then just to bring this into perspective, another report came out and showed that small business optimism remained at one of the highest readings in 43 years. And that's because the small businesses out there are awaiting new healthcare law, they're waiting for tax reform, and they're waiting for regulatory relief from Washington. So just like the larger companies, they're waiting for all those things, so are the small business owners. And this was according to the National Federation of Independent Business, the NFIB. Their index came out and came in at a reading of 105.3. So the NFIB president and CEO, Juanita Dugan, said that it's clear from their data at the NFIB that optimism skyrocketed after the election because small business owners anticipated a change in policy. So the sustainability of this surge and whether it will lead to actual economic growth depends on Washington's ability to deliver on the agenda that small business voted for back in November. So if it's really simple, if you just tune out all the noise, there's a lot of optimism right now. But if tax policy and tax reform and healthcare reform and some of these other things just kind of continue to be talked about with no action, you'll see the optimism fade. And obviously, that's not what anybody wants. So, well, I know some people are hoping for failure, kind of anti-business type folks. Why? I have no idea. But everybody's entitled to their own opinion. Now, the Treasury Department began employing emergency cash conservation steps this week to avoid breaching the federal borrowing limit. And that's because that limit has been suspended for 16 months. Well, that debt ceiling limit suspension expired this week. Analysts are watching as you see these cash management steps being taken to allow the Treasury to pay bills that come due without having to issue new debt until later in the fall. And, you know, depending on the strength of the Treasury receipts this spring and summer, we'll see if that all works out. After that, Congress, or meaning in the after spring and summer and we get into the fall, Congress would need to raise the borrowing limit or risk the U.S. missing certain payments, which has never been done and won't be done. The debt limit was introduced after the U.S. entered World War I. And it prevents the Treasury from issuing new securities to fund government activities once a certain debt level is reached. So that level reached $18.1 trillion in November of 2015. And again, the limit was suspended until March 15th, just this past week, the Ides of March. So people were talking on both sides of the aisle about this, as well as on Main Street. Congressman Dave Brat from Virginia, he's a deficit hawk, said firm commitments from the Trump administration to boost growth could help get conservatives on board with a vote to raise the debt limit. So even these deficit hawks and hardliners when it comes to monetary issues seem open, because like he said, no one wants to create uncertainty for markets or anything like that. But at the same time, Republicans, their brand is fiscal responsibility, especially some of them who wear it on their sleeves. So they have to demonstrate that. So it's going to be interesting because, again, they want growth and they're not afraid to spend money on that growth if it's going to be real or translate into real organic growth. But they don't just want the deficit, which is now bumping up against $20 trillion, just to continue to run up. So the Treasury uses extraordinary measures, such as redeeming certain investments in federal pension programs, suspending new investments in those programs, to raise funds without pushing the overall debt higher. But when it runs out of those measures, that's where they potentially could have a problem if the debt ceiling's not raised. So in a way, they're, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul. Because they're just taking it out of some existing funds that have to be replenished down the road. So we'll see how this goes. The main reason I'm bringing this up for you, and again, I'm trying to give you a lot of time, try to remember this, because this could be a real mess later in the year. And here's a perfect example of why. I saw this week that Senate Democrats warned Republicans, actually it was on Monday, it was the beginning of the week, that attempts to take funding away from Planned Parenthood or to pay for President Trump's border wall in this stopgap spending bill that's going to be coming up and have to be passed by late April would result in a government shutdown. So you've got the Treasury stuff going on. Now you've got this stopgap spending bill that has to be done by the end of April or late April. So the threat from the Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and other Democrat leaders really sets up the first showdown, if you will, for the president. I mean, this is where it's going to get real. It's not just going to be a volley of words back and forth. I mean, Schumer came out and said, if Republicans insist on inserting poison pill riders, such as defunding Planned Parenthood, building a border wall, or starting a deportation force, whatever that is, they will be shutting down the government and delivering a severe blow to the economy. So a spending bill keeping the government open is subject to a 60-vote threshold in the Senate. If Congress doesn't act, a partial government shutdown would begin on April 29th. Now, you might remember, but a Planned Parenthood funding fight brought Congress to the brink of shutting down the government back in March of 2011. And, of course, immigration has also been a major fight in previous spending bills, and I guess that's where they're using the word deportation force is supposed to get people scared. But there's a 16-day government shutdown that we have already experienced. That was in October of 2013, and you might remember that. That was really messy. It resulted in the furlough of hundreds of thousands of federal employees. And when I say messy, it really kind of unnerved the financial markets. So it's not clear yet if Democrats would actually carry out their threat if the White House and Republicans dare to block a bill to keep the government open. 10 Democratic senators face re-election in the 2018 midterm elections in states that President Trump won. So this is going to be extremely political, and it's going to be one of those things. It's either more rhetoric from people like Schumer, or if, again, it could lead to a serious concern about shutting down the government because the financial markets, once again, could get extremely nervous about that. So I want to try to plant that seed in your mind so that you're thinking about it and processing it, because that could be an event that investors might have to deal with down the road. Another top story this week, officials at Caterpillar, obviously Caterpillar is a huge heavy equipment maker. They're one of the 30 stocks in the Dow 30 for the Dow Jones Industrial Average, been around forever. Very successful company, but they have faced a lot of problems from federal investigators lately. And to help combat that, they hired a former U.S. Attorney General, William Barr, to help assess matters related to the things that they're dealing with as far as these government investigations. So Mr. Barr served under former President George H.W. Bush, and he's just going to help them over these federal probes. Earlier this month, as I told you here on the program, federal agents raided the company's headquarters in Illinois and also two nearby locations. And this is all coming about because of questions that are linked to a subsidiary in Switzerland. There's a parts business involved from what I heard, and just kind of whether Caterpillar is following the proper protocol or not. So you had agents from the IRS, the FDIC, or at least the Inspector General of the FDIC, the U.S. Department of Commerce, all involved in this these raids and investigations. Now, no arrests have been made. And Caterpillar said that Mr. Barr's experience in the public and private sector would help them as a company assess issues that have been raised, and obviously that they want to resolve with these government agencies. So we'll have to find out if, you know, if they've done something wrong. It apparently is relating to Caterpillar's offshore tax strategy. Most businesses do everything they possibly can legally to reduce their U.S. tax bill, just like consumers do. I've never met anybody that said, hey, you know, I feel like I didn't pay enough income tax this year. I'm going to, even though I don't owe anything, I'm going to, you know, send the government an extra $5,000, You know, so again, everybody does everything what they're legally entitled to do, because there's a difference, right? There's a difference between avoiding taxes, which is perfectly legal, and evading taxes, which is illegal. So we have to wait now and see if Caterpillar was doing things the right way or if they were doing things the wrong way. And it probably won't take too long to figure that out, assuming all of those organizations that I mentioned continue to stay engaged in the investigations. Now, when we look at the economic data, it's extremely boring to talk about inflation. But you know what? Just as boring as it is, it's that important, because inflation impacts all of us from all walks of life. And it's simply that things are going to get more expensive, just like they always have. And that means that the dollar that you have in your pocket, some of that purchasing power erodes away. And where you used to get a candy bar for 15 cents, now it costs you 75 or whatever. That's inflation. A stamp that used to cost you 10 cents now costs whatever. I don't even know. What is it, 49 cents, 50-some cents? That's inflation. It's real, but it creeps, so people don't pay a whole lot of attention to it, but you have to. We had two reports this week, U.S. producer prices, which is on the wholesale level, increased more than expected last month, and their year-over-year gain from February to February was the largest we've seen in nearly 5 years. So the Labor Department came out and said that its producer price index increased 0.3% last month, and the economists were looking for a 0.1% uptick. So that means prices, again, are inching their way up. And you might not feel it from year over year, but look back at some things that you've paid for in the past. The great stories are what your folks paid for their first home or their first car, or what college used to cost, or what a doctor's visit used to cost, or what food used to cost, you know, all those things. And then look at what they are now. That's inflation. And you have to factor it in if you want to be successful in your planning, both current budget planning if you're working, and really if you're near retirement or in retirement, you have to make sure you're accounting for inflation. Another one that came out was consumer prices, the CPI, Consumer Price Index. It rose in February as well. And, you know, it was up just 0.1% from a month earlier. That's what economists were looking for. That was their expectation, if you will. But that's still an increase. So keep that in mind, again, when we're talking later about navigating your financial journey and the things that you include, and hopefully you do include inflation, because it's a major part for you being successful in your pre-retirement and retirement years. U.S. retail sales barely inched ahead in February. Sales at U.S. retail stores and restaurants increased just 0.1% from the prior month. That was information from the Commerce Department. But again, that's what economists that were surveyed by the Wall Street Journal had expected, just 0.1%. Dig a little deeper in that report. There was some good news. January sales growth was revised up in that Wednesday report to show a gain of 0.6% in January versus the 0.4% that was originally reported. So that was solid, and it's always good to see that. Housing starts, single-family housing starts in February hit their highest level since we came out of the mess in 2008, 2009 during the financial crisis and the housing bust. So housing starts rose 3% in February from the previous month, and what wasn't so good is that permits, housing permits, which of course is an indication of how much construction we have in the pipeline right now, actually fell 6.2%. So that was much more than what was anticipated. So we'll keep an eye on that, because overall, housing sector has been doing very well. And then one other thing before we take a break. Since the election of President Trump, the stock market obviously has done well. Bond yields have risen, and economists have raised their forecast for economic growth. So forecasters in the Wall Street Journal's monthly survey of economists believe that the boost will be temporary, however, and not a permanent reset of the U.S. economy's ability to grow. Pretty interesting report. One of the friends of our program, Diane Swonk, she's been on the show here on the Your Financial Editor program. She was one of our guest speakers at one of our symposiums, along with a vice president from the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, and that was prior to the president of the bank, Jeffrey Lacker, coming a year or two later. But Diane Swonk heads her own economic firm now, and she said, "We have finally hit a sweet spot where economic gains are self-sustaining." But everybody's worried, including her, about going forward. So things are good now. But again, we need to see results. We need to see action. And if that's not the case, then it could be a different story. And it's not surprising to see that a lot of these economists in this survey, which, by the way, there were 61 from academic, financial, and business backgrounds as far as economists. It was conducted from between March 10th to March 13th. But 62% of them believe it is more likely growth will outperform than underperform. I love Diane Swonk. She's a great person. There's other folks that I like and respect as economists, but a lot of them are so wrong so often. I mean, they're worse than weather people. So, and they're political, especially when you get into academia. So that's one thing to consider, too, as we continue to hear reports from economists going forward. Okay, a quick break for you. And when we come back, I'll let you know what happened at the two-day meeting with the Federal Reserve. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Chris Murray, your financial editor on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD and streaming live worldwide at WFMD.com. And don't forget, if you miss any of the programming here on WFMD, you can go to the Audio Vault and listen to it there. Or the Your Financial Editor program is available via download from iTunes. So if you want to re-listen to a program or share a program with somebody, it's extremely easy to do. So, and also, we still have our latest white paper for you, titled Tax Strategies for Retirement. And that's on the website at murrayfinancialgroup.com. It's extremely interesting. It'll help you understand taxes in retirement. And all you have to do is go to murrayfinancialgroup.com, and it's a free download. Just download it and use it as you see fit. I mentioned right before the break there about the Federal Reserve. And this week they said that they were raising interest rates by a quarter percentage point, and they're going to continue to lift rates later in the year. So obviously they've really changed gears since the election, and they want to withdraw that easy money kind of policy that's been in the financial system. And they say they're going to do that as the economy continues to improve. They've penciled in probably two more quarter point rate increases this year. Janet Yellen basically said this week that the simple message is the economy's doing well. There's no, her comments weren't as measured as they have been the last, you know, 3 or 4 years since she was appointed, where she talked about modest and moderate and transitory and all kinds of words that really just made people go, huh? I mean, because you didn't really know what she was getting at. Now she's talking turkey. She's saying, again, the simple message is the economy's doing well. Another quote, we have confidence in the robustness of the economy and its resilience to shocks. And the only problem she had at that meeting was one dissenter, and that was the Minneapolis Fed President Neil Kashkari. He cast a dissenting vote on Wednesday because he wanted to hold rates steady right where they were. He didn't want an increase. He has kind of a different way of looking at things, and some people were questioning or trying to figure out why he did what he did. But the other thing that you have to remember here is that the Fed boosted its portfolio or its balance sheet, if you will, after the financial crisis and the housing bust with several rounds of quantitative easing. You remember me talking about it. All that is that they were buying stuff on a monthly basis. And when I say stuff, $4.5 trillion is the portfolio size now at the central bank. So just keep in mind, this is an experiment. They've never done this. The Federal Reserve has never been this meddlesome in its history. So how to unwind this $4.5 trillion that they've purchased is anyone's guess. I mean, I really don't know, as a lot of people don't know, how this is going to work out. But we'll keep an eye on it for you. And I'm sure it'll probably happen after she's gone. She's saying she's going to stay until February 2018. That's when her term's up. I seriously doubt that she'll be reappointed. So it'll happen after she's gone, I would imagine. Here's some news, and then we're talking about navigating your financial journey and long-term health care.
What you'll ever be.
Welcome back. This is Chris Murray, your financial editor on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD. That'll get you up in the morning. Talking right before that news break about one of the subjects that we were going to focus on this morning, navigating your financial journey. And I think it's appropriate. I mean, you know, when you're talking about accumulating wealth, it really is a journey. It takes work, commitment, persistence. You know, you have to be focused to a certain point. And reaching that destination can mean truly a better life and more security for yourself and for your family. So it's I think, really important, and again, deserves some time, because you start talking about confidence about your investments, and that requires being clear about your goals and comfortable with the advice that you get for reaching them and your whole planning process. And that's extremely important, the planning part. I mean, when you talk about creating and sticking with a plan, you know, you really should have, like we, for example, have a 7-step program, retirement process, if you will. It's a disciplined means for helping you navigate changing markets, which we've seen constantly the last 15 years. But you can use those steps, that process, that plan to implement and monitor investment strategies, for example, budget strategies, risk management. The process is backed by research. And obviously it's done to help you to make sure the things that you put in place are appropriate and proper for your particular situation, to help keep you on course. So, you know, to create a retirement strategy, for example, that is going to keep you on course, you need to understand, as do your advisors, circumstances and what you want to accomplish. So, you know, we work with a number of key questions. You have to identify, you know, what are your goals? What type of need or access will your capital play, as far as the money that you've accumulated, you've set aside and saved over time? What's your risk tolerance? That is so important these days. You know, which types of investments and strategies would be best for you based on your risk tolerance? Because, you know, some people, like right now, for example, things are rolling along pretty good, and that's great. But all of a sudden, like we saw during the financial crisis, when the bottom falls out and the market goes down over 50% from peak to trough, people's risk tolerance may change if they really haven't thought through that type of event. what a recession, not only an event there, but also what a recession would do to the portfolio. How long do recessions usually last? How long do bear markets usually last? Bear market is simple. It's when you have a declining trend of prices in the market, so the market's going down, versus just the opposite of bull market. You have a continuous trend for the most part of prices going up and the market going up. So you might believe that the key to successful investing is buying a diverse group of securities and holding them for years. But I'll tell you, over the past, as I mentioned, 10, 15 years, that approach alone hasn't always provided a real smooth path for people to walk on. When markets are volatile, it's particularly important to try to avoid deep losses in your portfolio. It's it's best to have a variety of strategies, approaches, investment theories to make sure you're best prepared for whatever type of market condition that you may experience. So, again, it's really about planning, about thought. It's important to talk about your view and obviously your advisor's views and you know, are things set up properly? Are you going to feel comfortable? You know what? There's great technology now that you can actually replicate the financial crisis and compare that to your exact portfolio, your exact holdings, whatever it is that you have. You can look at that today and then kind of transport yourself back to the financial crisis and say, hey, if I had this portfolio then, what would have happened? So instead of guessing, do I have the right investments, the right 401k, IRA, Roth, investment portfolio, whatever it may be, you can actually test it and see what it would be like if that were, or anything like that, were to hit your portfolio. So that would help you be, I think, more at ease in knowing what would happen to your portfolio. And then again, you know, making any necessary choices or changes in strategy. So it all comes down to having a good understanding of your risk tolerance, having a good understanding of your portfolio as it's laid out and that it is, in fact, appropriate for you. So I can't stress that enough, that you keep that in mind and make sure that it's in place for you, because you're going to be not only more successful, but I think you're going to be happier. You're going to eliminate a lot of anxiety, unnecessary stress, and worry. So just keep that in mind. Navigating your financial journey is it's very, very important. And I encourage you to take it extremely seriously so that you can maximize your success. All right, quick break here. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the impact of a long-term healthcare need and how it affects people, not just the person involved directly with the need, but also family and friends. Stay tuned. Welcome back. This is Chris Murray, your financial editor, on Free Talk Radio 930 WFMD, and of course, streaming live worldwide at WFMD.com. Thanks so much for being with us this morning. Long-term care, you know, like many of life's realities, the issues surrounding long-term care and the need to be prepared to deal with them are often something people prefer not to think about. Now, having a plan in place to address the possibility can go a long way toward easing some of the related concerns. So sometimes an event that warrants long-term care is unexpected, and sometimes it's gradual. We see it coming along. No matter the circumstances, a loved one's need for long-term care can create emotional, financial, and actually career impacts that extend far beyond the immediate situation. So just be focused on these five key insights, if you will. The changing face of long-term care. Caregiving can negatively impact health and well-being. Caregiver savings and retirement funds are at risk. Caregivers' careers and livelihoods are impacted by providing care. And number five, planning mitigates stress and negative impacts. So you've got this circle of care. Obviously, you have the recipient. You've got a primary caregiver. That could be a spouse, a child, a paid person. Then you've got a secondary caregiver, community support. You kind of look at it, it's like a bullseye with the care recipient in the middle, and then the next circle around it is primary, a little further out is secondary caregiver, and then further out is community support. So obviously the care recipient is the individual who requires this short or long-term care because of a physical, mental, or medical need. And then you've got this primary caregiver. It's the person who's responsible for providing assistance to the care recipient. This person often provides hands-on care and/or financial assistance. The secondary caregiver is a person who contributes financially and/or physically to a lesser degree than the primary. And then the community support. Additional support may come from friends, from your neighbors, from your church, from nonprofits, and just other community-type groups that are out there. But, you know, I talked about the changing face of long-term care. Just some statistics for you. 60% of caregivers are between 25 and 54 with an average of mid-40s. 52% are more likely to be the adult child of the care recipient. This is interesting. In this report that I saw, 50% of caregivers are evenly split between men and women. So it used to be that was kind of dominated by females, and that's not the case anymore. And 24% are other family members, more than in prior years. You have, you know, again, other folks than the immediate family providing some type of care. So what does that mean? If you're caregiving, that's hard. I mean, of course, we feel bad for and we want to care for and pray for those folks that are sick. But it's hard on the caregiver. I mean, 43% of those caregivers say that long-term care, that type of an event, negatively affected their personal health and well-being. 41% of those caregivers experienced negative physical side effects like depression. Nearly 33% of caregivers reported an extremely high level of stress. And 55% of caregivers did not feel qualified to provide physical care. That's a lot for folks. I mean, it's affecting them personally, their own health and well-being. They're having these side effects. They've got stress, high levels of stress, it said. They don't feel like they're adequate or qualified, which is typical for us, you know, because we want to be able to almost walk on water, you know, when we're taking care of somebody we care about. So our own standards that we have for ourselves are going to be raised extremely high. The other thing, caregiver savings and retirement funds are at risk. Well, that's, you see that happen. You've got a caregiver, they help provide financial assistance for the care of their loved ones. On average, they're doling out about $10,000 in out-of-pocket expenses. The financial expenses can include everything from household expenses, personal items, transportation services, you know, you name it. And I bet that most of those caregivers never anticipated or planned for that expenditure. When they were saving earlier in life and during midlife, you know, they weren't saying, oh, you know, make sure I set aside $10,000, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 for one or both of my parents or favorite aunt or uncle or whoever it may be, because they may need that. And I want to make sure that they get that level of care and retain their dignity, et cetera. So it's really, really hard for those caregivers. And it's not only emotional, but again, it's financial. So how do you get around it? Planning. That helps to mitigate the stress and the negative impacts. So, you know, if you just address it and plan for a potential long-term care health need, it's going to be so much easier, not only on you, because you'll be assured pretty much a higher level of care, but you won't be putting other people in that position that is not good for them. So that's just something to keep in mind. It's all about planning. And I would encourage you to definitely include long-term healthcare planning in all of your other planning. So I'm out of time, unfortunately, but we've got a really good piece up on the blog that came from JP Morgan's unit on retirement planning. I think that you'll want to read. So go to murrayfinancialgroup.com, read that article by the lady's name is Mrs. Roy, and I think you'll enjoy what she has to say and find it very eye-opening, because that's her sole focus is retirees. So that does it for us. Have a great rest of the weekend. I'll talk with you next week on the Morning News Express, 550, 650, 750 every weekday morning. And then we'll see you back here next Saturday at 8. This is Chris Murray wishing you and your family financial success.